Vice Chancellor, thank you very much for the kind words, introduction. I'm very happy to see so many faces here, old friends, colleagues, and people I don't know, but I assume they're interested in the subject of my talk. So let's start. The title, A Twisted Tale of Memory Research, and I carry on, but I show you something here, which I hope will work. Yes, I have my little snail crawling up there. So I'm working with snails, and I'm going to tell you a twisted tale about memory research, and I will try to explain how the humble snail can help us to understand how we learn and remember. This one is not working very well. I need to stand here. Okay, so one of the first questions I would like to discuss with you is, why study mechanisms of memory? Now, there are many answers to this very simple question, but the most inspirational answer to me came from a book written by Eric Kandel and Larry Squire. It is called Memory, From Networks to Molecules, or From Mind to Molecules. And there are two pieces of text in this book that have caught my attention. We are who we are because we can remember what we have thought about, okay? Memory is the glue that binds our mental life. It's a kind of scaffolding that holds our personal history together. But even more importantly, if things go wrong, our memory is lost, as for example in Alzheimer's disease, then we lose our ability to recreate our past and we lose our personality and link to other people in the world. And this is one of the most important reasons why neuroscientists such as myself are interested in working with memory, trying to answer the questions about how to improve memory or reverse memory loss. So that lies at the core of our research, no matter what we pretend we do. Of course, you might have wondered, why is this a twisted tale of memory research? Well, apart from the obvious, snails have coiled, twisted shells. There's another very important reason for this, because in ordinary tales, there's always, once upon a time, there was a little dog, or once upon a time, there is a little rat. And ordinary tales of memory research, such as the one told by Ivan Pavlov or Richard Morris, are always about these nice furry animals that we know are quite clever. So in the case of Pavlov's experiment, as many of you, I'm sure, know, if you have a dog, you ring a bell, the dog doesn't do much, it doesn't salivate or doesn't pretend that it wants to eat. However, if you then pair the bell, in this case a hamburger, then the dog starts salivating, okay? And if you give it the food, then it learns that ringing the bell signals the arrival of food. And after a while, just upon hearing the bell, the dog will start salivating. So that's a Pavlovian conditioning experiment. Very simple, very old experiment, often used in behavioral analysis of learning and memory. Now this is a slightly more tricky type of experiment. This is the famous water maze experiment, in which a rat is placed into a pool of water, which has opaque water in it. The rat cannot see where it's swimming, and there's a hidden platform somewhere here, and the poor rat is swimming around like crazy, cannot find the platform. After a while, however, it bumps into it, and then it learns how to find it quickly, and after about 10 or 15 trials, the rat, this white creature here, just swims straight to the platform. If you damage the hippocampus of this animal, then it cannot perform the task. But that's a talk for another occasion. Okay, I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to talk about is that the main character in my twisted tale is the snail. So all the things that other people do with dogs and rats, I'm doing with snails. So that's why I call this a twisted tale. Okay, so why is this a twisted tale then? What's twisted about working with snails? The reason is very simple. If you look at this evolutionary tree, and forget the details, I'm not going to talk through this. If you look at where the snail is and where man is, this is Charles Darwin, this is the famous BBC evolutionary tree, which you can download free. And then you put a timeline on it, then you immediately realize that there's at least 600 million years separating what? Not the snail and Darwin, but the last common ancestor of snail and man. This is very important. So it's not the snail itself, because snails live today, okay? But it's the common ancestor of snail and man, 600 million years. So if you imagine what happened during that time in evolution, you can imagine how distant snails and human beings are from each other. Now this is exacerbated by the fact that human evolution was incredibly fast. In the last 5 million years, from Monkeus italotis, we went to Homo sapiens, okay? That's an incredibly fast rate of evolution. While, if you look at a fossilized snail, this is a snail shell, a limnaeus shell, from 50 million years ago, and you look at something that you just collected from your pond, then you will realize they are absolutely identical. You could actually put these into this. So there has been almost no evolution in the snail world over the past 50 million years. And we assume that that hadn't been much before that either. 50 million years, incredibly slow evolution at a snail's pace, very fast evolution. Okay, so why on earth then anyone would want to work with snails and find out about human beings? Well, a small detour. I have to tell you that snails have inspired many artists. Many of them are very famous. This is Salvador Dali, for example. And they produced wonderful pieces of art, from the mystical, romantic, subtle, down to the kind of, you know, outright pornographic. I apologize for this. I hope there are no kids in the audience, okay? And I show you my favorite. This is Miro's painting, which is called Snail, Woman, Flower, and Star. Figure out which one is which. I couldn't, but I love the painting. Okay, all right, artists like snails. But why would snails inspire a bearded neuroscientist interested in memory? Okay, so that's the question. Well, I'll give you an answer. I'm watching your faces. The answer is because the snail brain is not a bicycle. Okay? Question marks. I'm watching your faces. Well, I will walk you through this kind of entire explanation, and I hope I will convince you that indeed the snail brain is not a bicycle. So let's imagine that we have a couple of aliens who have just managed to steal a concept car, all right? And they keep it in their spaceship. This is the concept car, and they treat it as a sacred object. They're not allowed to touch it. They are not allowed to take it to pieces. They're not allowed to drive it, okay? But they're burning with the desire to understand how it works and what it does. Now, they had also stolen other objects, such as a Trabant car. I used to drive one of these, by the way. And a concept bicycle. This is a carbon fiber titanium 10,000-pound bicycle, okay? And they need to decide which one to choose to take to pieces to understand how this beast works. Now, what they don't know, of course, and they cannot make this decision without this knowledge, is this. Okay? So if you look at the evolution of cars and bicycles, okay, you will see that the last common ancestor of all things on wheels was a wheel, which this chappy is just making. Okay? Now, there was a divergence then. It went to the internal combustion engine creatures, okay, which is the last common ancestor of Trabant and the concept car. Okay? But all the other things on wheels went this way, or most of them. So this is the evolution of the bicycle. Okay? Now, the other thing I have to tell you, that the Trabant was first produced in the 50s. Some Trabants have fallen by the wayside, as you can see here. Found much better uses. But believe it or not, there are still many Trabants running in what used to be East Germany, and also in my home country, Hungary. When we go home, we also see Trabants. And Trabant is the favorite car of my daughter Panna here. Okay? So why am I telling you this kind of slightly stupid story about the aliens trying to figure out what to do? Obviously, because the question then arises, what links the Trabant and the concept car, and what differentiates them from the concept bicycle? Well, the answer is very simple. Trabant and the concept car has an internal combustion engine, whereas this relies on pedal power, okay? The question now is, can we use the bicycle if we want to understand how the concept car works? And obviously the answer is no, all right? Now the question is then, can we use the trabant to understand how the concept car works? Yes or no? Okay, I heard some no's, some yeses. I think yes. We will never be able to understand how all the features, all the fancy features of the concept car work, the GPS and all the other stuff, but how the internal combustion engine works and how it propels a vehicle can be understood if you take the car to pieces, the Trabant to pieces, put it together again and drive, okay? So from here, I kind of know that you know what's coming next. By analogy, I tell you how the evolution of the snail and the human being is linked, okay? The story starts with some ancestral jellyfish-type creatures called cnidarians, okay? This is a fossil creature which was found in sediment, dated 70 million years old. And from this, there was a divergence of the evolution, coming up this way, branching here, and coming up to today's jellyfish, wonderful large creatures, very, very dangerous. So what really links human beings and snails is that they have brains. They have a central nervous system, whereas jellyfish do not have a central nervous system. They have nerve nets, which is a huge difference, okay? Now, of course, you know, this was a stupid little joke, but I show you what the ancestral animal looked like, probably, that gave rise to both snails and human beings. This looked like a small slug. It was bilateral, so it belonged to the group of bilaterian animals, and this creature already had an ancestral brain, and that creature lived about 60 million years ago. So that's the common ancestor of snail and man. This is a common ancestor of jellyfish, snail, and man. But jellyfish evolved completely separately from both snail and human beings, okay? Now the next issue is, so can we use the jellyfish brain, or nerve net rather, to understand how the human brain works in very, very basic forms? And of course, by analogy to the bicycle, no. Can we understand certain aspects of the workings of the human brain, if you look at the organization of the snail brain? And the answer is, as you expect, yes. So this is why I'm saying that the snail brain is not a bicycle, okay? Because you can use it to understand the basic, the most fundamental functions of the human brain. And in the rest of my lecture, I will be trying to convince you that this is actually true, because you might not believe me at this point, okay? Well, the next question is, all right, let's accept we can use snails. Question is, what particular snail species we should use? Vice Chancellor already hinted that I've been using two different types, but prior to sort of setting out on this research, I had many, many more options, such as, well, I'm not going to talk about these because my wife did not approve me using any of these creatures, but this is a Plesia californica. I did try using this. I didn't like it very much. And this is Hermes and the Crassicornis. These are nudibranch mollusks. They live in shallow Californian waters. They're beautiful creatures, very large, but very difficult to use. And in England and in Hungary, I had no access to them. So I had all these choices, some more limited than the others. And of all these beautiful creatures, which one did I choose? This one, okay? The humble, boring, common pond snail, or great pond snail, as they call it. Slightly more fancy name than common pond snail. Question is, why did I choose this creature? This is the great pond snail Limnaeus stagnalis, Linnaeus 1758, because it has a beautiful brain. And this is something I learned from Professor Paul Benjamin, who is sitting there. So it has a beautiful brain. Moreover, this has sort of ganglia, which I'm not going to go into the details of. You can label them up and you can identify them. Moreover, you can identify almost every single neuron in some of these ganglia. So these are some neurons. This wonderful shape is a bunch of neurons. It looks like a bunch of grapes. This is a so-called axonal backfilling, when you put the cut end of a nerve into a fluorescent dye, and then the dye creeps up into the ganglia, creeps up into the cell bodies and it stains them. And if you put this preparation under a fluorescent microscope, you can see these beautiful images. And every single blob here, the little yellow circles, is an individual neuron of the snail nervous system. Okay, you can look at them, you can put microelectrodes in them, you can do many interesting things with them. Another way of finding neurons in the system is to get the neurons by microelectrodes and directly inject some dyes into them. And then what the dye does, it spreads into the axonal arborization of these neurons, and you can reveal how they are interconnected and where they are relative to other neurons in the brain of the animal. So this is a sort of beauty of the brain and the neurons that had huge attraction for me. Now, a bit of a history of how it all started. In Sussex was already very famous in the late 70s about Paul Benjamin's work on the identification of the neuronal network underlying the generation of feeding in this creature. And in 1983, I came here for a short visit, but I was actually working with Chris Elliott, so I joined this teamwork, and we made quite good progress with this, and lots of people worked on this. As a result of that, this system became one of the best identified central pattern generator systems in neuroscience. A bit later, I came back again, and that was when I started food reward classical conditioning of snails, which is basically the type of Pavlovian conditioning which is very similar to giving food to dogs after ringing the bell. Okay, I will explain how this works. Obviously, I didn't ring any bells to the snails. And this is some old pictures I took when I was first here. This is a snail electrophysiology laboratory with microscopes, a microscope and amplifiers and a very old BBC computer. And this is the very first snail learning laboratory that I built in 1986 at Sussex. This was in the corner of what's now known as the PhD room. Okay, so PhD students who sit there, remember, this is the place where it all started. Okay, but very soon, it evolved into a big business, so to speak. So these two disparate lines of research came together. This happened in the early 90s, during the time of the establishment of the Sussex Center for Neuroscience that was headed by Professor Michael O'Shea. And that's when we started in earnest the investigation of the cellular and molecular mechanisms of memory in what was by then an identified motor network, the feeding network of the pons snail limnea sternalis. And this is just the lab as it looks today. It hasn't changed much except for a very fancy computer and also a very fancy large microscope which is equipped with an imaging camera that allows you to take pictures of neurons and how calcium and other molecules move into and out from the neurons. Okay, but apart from that, things haven't changed much. So, what can you do in this lab, in an electrophysiology lab with a snail? Well, unfortunately, you cannot leave it completely intact. What you need to do, you need to reveal where the brain is. This is a zoom in onto the head area of the animal. Now, if you open up the skin here by dissecting it, then you can reveal this big muscle, which is the main feeding muscle of the snail, called the Bakker mass. And this is the brain. If you peel away the muscle, you will find the brain in its beauty. It's very nicely pigmented, orange pigmented. But you don't stop there. You move down one level, and then you can place what we call microelectrodes into these large neurons. These are about 100 micrometer in diameter. As the Vice Chancellor pointed out, these are giant neurons. And what you can do then is you can place these micropipettes or microelectrodes into them. These are filled with a fluid that can conduct electricity. And the whole system is then linked to an amplifier, so you can actually eavesdrop on neurons communicating with each other. So that's the basic principle of electrophysiology. When you do that, you can actually find out how these neurons fire, how they produce action potentials, how they synapse to each other, and how they work together as a neuronal network. So that's the significance of this wonderful method called electrophysiology. So what are the things you can do with this? In the case of the snail, you can reduce this poor creature into what we call a semi-intact preparation. A semi-intact preparation is just the sensory areas and the muscles kept together with the brain and linked together by nerves. So that's called a semi-interpreparation. This is very, very difficult to develop in invertebrate animals, of course. Now, what you can do in these preparations is that you can investigate what we call neural correlates of the feeding behavior, i.e. the electrophysiological expression of the behavior. And this can be studied in these so-called semi-interpreparations. And in 1983, at my first visit, this was the main job I did here. I developed this preparation here, which has been very successfully used for all sorts of experiments, including learning and memory type experiments. I just show you one example. I'm not going to show you. I'm a trained electrophysiologist, but I promise I'm not going to show you many detailed electrophysiological recordings, but I couldn't resist showing you this one. So what this is all about? What happened here is that I placed four electrodes in the same brain into four different neuron types. This neuron is an interneuron. It's called a gating interneuron because its activation is necessary for feeding to start. This chap here is called a central pattern generator interneuron because it is primarily responsible for generating the activity that drives the entire system. Okay? This neuron here is a motor neuron because it provides direct innervation to the muscles, which are the main effector organs of feeding and all sorts of behavior in general. And this is an interesting neuron. It's called the slow oscillator. The name doesn't matter. It's a frequency modulating interneuron because it has the ability to somehow modulate the frequency of the feeding bursts. Okay? So I walk you through this slightly complicated figure. Of course, this is time and this is voltage. So we're recording the electrical activity. When the trace goes up, it means that the neuron actually fires a spike. When there are many, many spikes together, it's called a burst of spikes. Okay, so and this is a sequence of bursts of spikes. And we then here mapped this electrical activity onto the real behavior, of course not the same animal, but an average animal. And what you see here is the typical sequence of feeding behavior in the snail. If you have snails in your aquarium or pond, you can watch them feed on algae, and this is what you see. This is about a sequence lasting for about 6 seconds, and the animals open their mouth, there is phase called protraction, then they rasp on the surface, and they swallow the food. Okay, I don't want to go into the details more. But what's really, really important is that due to the early work of Paul Benjamin and others, this sort of behavioral sequence has been very closely mapped onto the electrical activity of these neurons. And all I did here in this experiment was to directly demonstrate that this is indeed the case. So up to this point, nothing happens. Then here, we apply sugar to the lips. This sugar is a natural food stimulus for the snails. They love it. Now, if you watch carefully, this guy here, the gating interneuron is activated first, followed closely by the central pattern generator interneuron number 2, and then followed by the motor neuron, the guy who innervates the muscles and makes them twitch and contract. And finally, the modulatory interneuron steps in and produces this very beautiful regular ring in the whole system. And when you remove the feeding stimulus, you wash out sugar, then the whole thing occurs in reverse. So the whole system slows down, and then finally it stops. So this is a direct demonstration that a food stimulus can drive what we call fictive feeding rhythm, which is the electrical correlate of the real behavior in this semi-intact preparation. Okay? And this is a summary figure which is the result of the work of many, many people over a large number of years. And this is just a summary of the sensory, modulatory, central pattern generator, and motor neurons of the snail brain, and its link to the three-phase rhythmic behavior, which is feeding. And those of you who work with vertebrates might actually spot many similarities, because we know the transmitter content of many of these neurons. For example, serotonin, nitric oxide, acetylcholine, glutamate. We suspect there's also dopamine in some of these neurons, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to go into the details of this. There are many connections between these neurons, electrical connections, chemical inhibitory and excitatory connections. It's a mini brain. It's a properly wired mini brain with many, many similarities to small circuits in the mammalian, including the human brain. Okay? Now, but I want to use this for learning and memory studies. So how do I go about it? You have to construct a conceptual framework before you embark on the investigation of how memory forms in a neuronal network, even a very well identified one, such as the snail feeding network, and also how to investigate the encoding, maintenance, and retrieval of the memory trace. And of course, the first thing you do is you do some kind of behavioral analysis. You try to teach the animals to do something, because if an animal cannot learn, then it's not a good object, you know, to investigate learning and memory. Okay, so let's assume you can do classical conditioning, similar to Pavlov's dogs. Then you have to go down to the level of neuronal networks. You need to look at what we call the neural expression of the learned response, okay, or the electrophysical readout of the memory trace. And if you are very, very ambitious, like I was, you go down to the level of the molecules. What it means is that you look at the role of learning-induced activation of certain intracellular signaling cascades and genes. These are basically very important molecules, proteins, DNA, RNA, et cetera, that are playing very important roles in the formation of long-term memory. So this is the conceptual framework for this. I'm not going to talk too much about this, well, none at all, because this would lead too far and that too rich a subject. I'm going to concentrate on the behavioral and molecular analysis aspects of the work. So, some basics. Snails like sugar. This is a piece of Brighton rock, and they are crazy for it. What it means is then that you can use sugar as a reward in exactly the same way as Pavlov used meat powder in his famous Pavlovian or classical conditioning experiments. So snails like sugar, and we can use sugar to reward the snails if they do something, okay, if they behave. Now, in practice, this is how it works. You need to find a stimulus that activates feeding, sugar, and you need to find another stimulus, which is a chemical stimulus in this particular case. It's called amyl acetate. You may not be able to read it very well from there. It's pear drops. It has a very pleasant smell, but does not normally activate feeding in snails. Okay? And the snails don't know what to do with it, so there are lots of question marks here. What you do next is very simple. You bring these two together, so you give the animal both amyl acetate and sugar. And then there's a connection being made in the snail's head or brain, which tells it that amyl acetate means food. This is just a very common case of classical conditioning. Okay. Finally, you go back and retest the same animal after a day or 2 weeks or whatever, just with the amyl acetate, the pear drops, and lo and behold, the animal will respond to amyl acetate as if it was food. It will produce feeding movements in response to the non-food stimulus. So this is a typical example of classical conditioning. What's very important, however, for the neuroscientists is that it lasts for a long time. You know that a week is a long time in politics. Now, 2 weeks is a very long time in the life of a snail, okay? So these snails actually remember the task for about 3 weeks, okay? So these green bars, which are much taller than the yellow ones, indicate that on day one through day three and day 14, the animal still remembered the relationship between amyl acetate and food. So they responded by producing feeding movements to the amyl acetate stimulus alone. This is very important because this is called long-term memory or long-lasting memory. And it's very similar to what we find in vertebrates, of course. So this combination of what I call a robust paradigm and the creature, which has a very well-identified feeding network and also some other nice neuronal networks, I have to add, provided an incredibly good starting point for molecular level analysis of learning and memory. So this is why I started working with it and dared embark on a molecular level analysis of memory formation in this creature. And then in 1996, there was a revelation in my life. I read a review. This was written by Tom Carew, who was at that time working at Yale University. And its title is Molecular Enhancement of Memory Formation. And this article was about the role of a transcription factor, which is called the cyclic AMP response element binding protein. It's a transcription factor because it can activate genes and make them do things, i.e. produce messenger RNA and produce new proteins, which are all very important components of the formation of long-term memory. So I sat at my computer, and this drawing was actually made by my daughter Fujino, and started thinking about CREB and enhancement of memory formation. And the questions that were kind of turning around in my brain, and I was checking them on PubMed, et cetera, were concentrated on this. Why target this particular pathway, which is called the cyclic protein kinase CREB pathways, in studies of memory function and dysfunction, which is what my plan was? And this was the time when I was applying for an MRC senior research fellowship, which I got eventually. And these were the questions. This was the question, and these are the answers I came up with. Well, the first answer to this question is that if you want to look at molecular targets for studies on learning and memory, then you need to go for candidates that act as so-called molecular switches during memory formation. These molecules are responsible from turning short-term memory into long-term memory. There are many things that you do in your life that you never remember again, for example, where you place your keys and such like. But there are many important things that you must remember, and these things are turned into long-lasting memory traces in your brain by the action of these molecular switches. And the transcription CREB factor CREB is one of these very important, if not the most important, molecular switches, okay? This is why I started concentrating it towards the end of the 90s, 1998, 1999. And the important thing about dealing with these molecules and working on learning and memory-related problems is that you need to understand the mechanism of the activation of this type of molecule in order to understand and influence all the cellular and molecular mechanisms of what I call memory function, either normal working of memory, but much more importantly, dysfunction when things go wrong and we want to do something about it. So you need to understand how these guys like CREB and others work in the brain. And this is what I set out to do about 12 years ago. All right. So again, let's just go into a detail a little bit. And I promise not to tell you too much about this. One very important thing that was already established in the sort of late 90s, is that the key molecular mechanisms of long-term synaptic plasticity are evolutionarily highly conserved. Okay? What does this mean, evolutionarily highly conserved? This simply means that the basic components, which are all arrowed here, these red arrows are pointing at molecules in cells of the sea slug, Aplysia californica, and also in the human or the mammalian hippocampus, these arrowed molecules, PK, cyclic AMP, et cetera, are all the same. They're shared between invertebrates and vertebrates. They look very similar in structure. They play very similar roles. They're encoded by very, very similar genes. This means that these have been evolutionarily conserved from invertebrates to vertebrates, okay? And this had already been extremely well worked out. But what were the systems in which they worked out? These systems were simple cultures of neurons, or so-called hippocampal slices, which is such a small section of the brain, if you like. And the big problem was that although a lot of progress had been made by that time, no one really knew how the wonderful mechanisms they described, the activation of genes and short-term memory mechanisms, et cetera, how they actually map onto the behavior of real animals. So the relevance to learning and memory in intact animals was completely unclear. And this is why I decided to embark on what I call a top-down approach to the study of memory. So unlike Eric Kandel and other people who were the pioneers of the synaptic plasticity field, I decided to start with analysis of the behavior of the real intact animal and then work my way down and find out what molecular mechanisms underlie learning and memory and what roles they actually play. So this is called the top-down approach. The other type of approach is called the reductionist or cellular reductionist approach. And of course, I'm not the only one who uses this approach. Many, many people are concentrating on various different systems using this, what, about what's called the top-down approach. Now, I just show you an example of an incredibly elegant experiment that Maria Ribeiro did in my lab when she was working there as a postdoc. We set out to identify the transcription factor CREB because we thought that if we cannot find it in the snail, there's no point in using the snail to investigate CREB-dependent mechanisms. It's fair enough, isn't it? So what we did then is we performed a type of experiment which is called electrophoretic mobility shift assay, or EMSA for short. And I promise I'm not going to tell you a lot more about this type of experiment in future slides, but I want to tell you about this one. So before we go on and talk about the actual experiment, I have to show you the arrangement. This is a DNA, and the DNA has a promoter region and has coding regions as well. Now there's another region here, which is called the CRE region, and this is the region to which the CREB, which is the CRE element, cyclic AMP response element binding protein, is actually binding. So this is recognizing the molecule and binds to it. And this binding of CREB to the CRE region of the DNA will kick into action all the subsequent events, which is basically the production of messenger RNA molecules via the process of transcription, which is the copies made from one strand of the DNA, and eventually the translation of these messenger RNA molecules into working proteins. This is a vast oversimplification of how this happens, but if you understand that CREB actually binds to this region and then it activates the gene, then you will understand the experiment I'm going to tell you about. So for this experiment, what you need to do, you need to produce a long strand, single strand of DNA, which has the so-called CRE regions, three of them in this particular case. And then you need to label it with a radioactive label so you know where it is. You need to run it on a gel in an electrophoretic situation where you put it into electric field. And because it's charged, it will run all the way down in the absence of proteins that cannot bind to it in this particular case. So this large dark field here is all the DNA molecules containing all the CRE elements that have run through the gel and disappeared into this void. Now the next part of the experiment is that you take a snail and you make an extract of the snail's brain, so all the proteins in the snail's brain are there. And you want to find the proteins that actually catch the CRE regions. So you mix the DNA together, the labeled DNA together with the proteins, and run them on another gel, okay? And what you find then is that you find that there will be four bands, all representing a protein which has latched onto the CRE region and therefore slowed down of the running of the DNA on the gel. And this is called a shift for obvious reasons. It slows down the progress of the DNA because the molecule becomes much heavier. So it's very simple. So this method first identified these four proteins that are good candidates for being CRE binding proteins, which is a definition, that a criterion for CREB. Subsequently, what Maria did was this. She set up another experiment in which, again, there was a band. There were four bands on a gel, the usual kind of bands, the four proteins. But then she did a very smart thing. She mixed DNA containing non-labeled CRE with labeled DNA in a way that the unlabeled DNA had a much, much higher concentration. So it was competing with the labeled DNA for catching CREB from the limnea brain extracts. And in this particular case, we saw nothing. So all the DNA gathered at the bottom of the gel, which means that there were no proteins caught by the DNA, okay? Now, if you use a random sequence, which I'm not showing here, a random sequence or a mutated sequence, it does not affect the ability of these CRE binding proteins to bind to the labeled DNA, and therefore, again, you will find the four protein bands here, okay? So this was the second phase of the experiment. Now, the most ingenious thing, however, about the whole experiment was, and what Maria did then, is she mixed a CREB, a human CREB antibody, with the protein and the DNA. And then what happened is that she found that this band, which is number two, actually shifted up, I slowed down. Why? Because the human CREB antibody, which is an immunological antibody that recognizes CREB specifically, was bound to this complex, which is the labeled DNA, protein number two complex, and it slowed it down even further, i.e. we produced a super shift. Now this kind of very elegant experiment provides direct demonstration of the presence of a functional limnel homolog of human CREB1. And this is the very first time when this was shown, okay? And later on, a Japanese group actually cloned the limnel CREB gene, and they found out that the homology between the limnel and the human CREB gene was about 89%. So at the level of proteins and at the level of DNA and genes, the homology is very, very strong. A further experiment that we did demonstrated that when we used a chemical called forskolin that can activate adenylate cyclase enzyme, which is the main synthase enzyme for cyclic AMP, if you use this on snail brain extracts, you can actually increase the phosphorylation of CREB. Phosphorylation of CREB is the main way by which CREB is activated in the brain to fulfill its role as a transcriptional activator. And this is just a kind of direct demonstration using Western blotting, and this is just the sort of graphical representation of the results. If you use an inactive form of forskolin, which is called dideoxyforskolin, you get nothing. If you use increasing concentrations of the forskolin molecule, you get increasing levels of phosphorylation of the cyclic AMP response element binding protein. And it's demonstrated here using a statistical principle. Okay? So, let's move on. So what can we do with CREB? What we can do with it, we can investigate what role it might play in associative learning and memory in the cell. For this, you have to do very complicated experiments, as the psychologist amongst you can attest to this. You need to do these experiments because very often people confuse associative type learning with other types of learning, such as non-associative learning, i.e. sensitization. So we set up lots of different groups. One of them was naive. There were animals that were just handled, picked up, put back into the tank. There were animals that were only receiving sugar or amyl acetate or the both stimuli in an unpaired manner. And there was a main group, which is the main experimental group, that receives both the conditioned stimulus and the unconditioned stimulus, i.e. amyl acetate and sugar. So there are many, many groups. And what you do then, you subject these animals to these particular training protocols. 6 hours later, you dissect one half of the animals in each group, and you subject them to biochemical assays based on Western blotting to detect the level of phosphorylated CREB in these brains. But you save the other half of each group to perform behavioral tests much later on, such as 24 hours after learning. Okay? So there are two different groups of animals, but they all come from the same big batch of animals. And what we found here is a very strong correlation between the level of phosphorylation of CREB in the brain and the level of associative memory in the whole behaving animals. It's a very strong correlation here between the two phenomena. And nothing really happens in these groups which are not subjected to associative type conditioning. Okay. So I speed up a little bit. So we had all the major components in place that were already described also in mammals. So we knew about CREB, phosphorylation of CREB, et cetera, et cetera. What we didn't know about is what protein kinase A was doing. Protein kinase A is one of the most important molecules, key molecules in the system. So we embarked upon a cloning of the protein kinase A enzyme, and I'm happy to say that Max Mikkel, who was a very talented student working in my lab, was successful in cloning the protein kinase A. This is the very first example of protein kinase A cloned in Limnaea stagnalis, and all its structural features are incredibly similar to that of the pKa derived from the human brain. After cloning this molecule, we prove that protein kinase A plays a very important and very complex role in learning and memory in the snail. It is involved in the formation of both intermediate-term memory and long-term memory in particular time windows, but much more importantly, we showed that it was also involved in the reconsolidation of memory following retrieval. Memory traces can reconsolidate once they are retrieved if you interrupt this retrieval process or interrupt the action of protein kinase A, then you can actually abolish the memory trace. It's a very important finding from the year 2000 in vertebrates, and the same system also seems to be present in this invertebrate animal. So we had maps of phases of memory formation with molecules linked to them, but what we didn't know at this point in time, which was in 2006, is what happens during a very late phase of memory consolidation. So with my colleague, Huimin Wen, and others, we embarked upon an investigation of a very interesting enzyme called CAM kinase, calcium calmodulin kinase, which is a fantastic enzyme. It has a beautiful shape. It's like a hairpin, a closed hairpin. But when you open it and pop it up with some molecules, then it becomes very active and stays autoactive for a long time to come. So it's an excellent candidate molecule or signaling molecule involved in late memory consolidation processes. And we did lots of experiments, mainly behavioral pharmacological type experiments and cloning experiments. This from work that was published earlier this year in the Journal of Neuroscience. And this is the sequence of the limne and human CAM kinase. And again, you see that the homology is about 90% between the two sequences. This is very important, of course. And then we run, again, biochemical type experiments such as Western blotting and correlative memory tests. And we again established that there's a huge correlation between the phosphorylation of this molecule, or the activation of this molecule, and the expression of the memory trace at a later time point. This is the kind of blueprint for all the types of experiments that people do when they want to find out about the role of an activation of the particular molecule in long-term associative memory. Okay? Now, a little summary of what we found about CAM kinase. This is a very exciting finding. CAM kinase is a very hot molecule in learning and memory research. There is a delayed intrinsic activation of CAM kinase. It happens in a critical time window, and this activation is actually necessary for late consolidation of memory in limnea. And there are other interesting findings. I don't want to go into the details of this. The important thing is that this process of activation, spontaneous activation of CAM kinase, appears to facilitate the preservation of long-term memory in the face of protein turnover. Of course, proteins come and go, and also probably has a role to play in preventing forgetting of memories. Okay. So, by January 2010, we already had a much more complete picture, and we knew that late consolidation was somehow driven by the activation of the CAM kinase molecule. So that's fine, but there were still gaps in our understanding. This is a very schematic diagram about the sequence of events, how the adenylate cyclase enzyme is activated, how it produces cyclic AMP, how it activates PK, etc., etc. What we didn't know, however, what activates adenylate cyclase? Obviously, it's a crucial question. If you don't know who starts the whole process, you know nothing about the mechanism of learning and memory in this creature. So the question was, what is the neurotransmitter that binds to what we call a G protein-coupled receptor and subsequently activates adenylate cyclase? Well, my attention came to focused on this particular molecule, which is called the pituitary adenylate cyclase activating polypeptide. Quite a mouthful, isn't it? We call it PACAP. And this was first identified in the vertebrate, in the mammalian brain, of course. And this is a molecule that plays an incredibly important role in hormonal regulation in the vertebrate, in the mammalian brain. But also in the mammals, it plays a role in learning and memory. So we thought, all right, we will try to investigate this in the snail brain. And Jod Pirger, who was working with me in 2007, did some fantastic experiments in which he used a human antibody targeted against PACAP and threw it onto the snail brain and found incredibly beautiful staining, fluorescent staining, indicating the presence of a highly conserved PACAP-like molecule in the brain of limnea sternalis. This shows the area where the lip nerves enter the brain, and this is the branching area. And this area is very important because it's the main sensory and integrating area of the snail brain that is hugely important for learning and memory formation. So with this kind of, you know, morphological underpinning and lots of other experiments, Maldi-Toff type experiments in which the protein was actually identified, we embarked on another project in which we demonstrated that the activation of PACAP is actually necessary for the formation of long-term memory when we use a single-trial classical conditioning, which is regarded as a strong classical conditioning paradigm, because it works instantaneously just with one trial. So this shows that when the animals were treated either 2 hours before or about 8-10 minutes after training with an inhibitor of PACAP, then the animals forgot. They couldn't learn or they forgot what they learned. This doesn't happen if the animals were injected with this inhibitor about 6 hours after training. This was an interesting observation, but what was really exciting is this. We also showed that when we use a much weaker training paradigm, when you have to repeat the pairing of a mechanical stimulus, a tactile stimulus with sugar many, many times, that you can actually improve the performance of the animals if you inject them with PACAP directly. Okay? So what happens here is that this increase in the performance of the animals shows that both 90 minutes and 18 hours after training, the performance is enhanced, which means that both short-term and long-term memory has been improved by the direct application of this molecule, the adenyl cyclase activating vertebrate molecule. Okay, so the summary of the PACAP story is as follows. We found an invertebrate homolog of a vertebrate adenyl cyclase activating peptide. We found that this is both expressed in the brain of the mollusk, limnea sternalis, and it is both necessary and instructive for robust and rapid memory formation, which is a very exciting observation because we can now start exploring the ways by which manipulating PACAP-dependent pathways in either the invertebrate or vertebrate brain might actually change the ability of the animals to form memories. So then we constructed this frighteningly complex diagram, which is a synthesis of all the known molecular players in the limnea brain that contribute to learning and memory. Again, I'm not going to go through the details or this sort of published material. What I want to point out is that all these players are present in the mammalian brain. Every single neuron that is capable of synaptic plasticity or learning and memory plays a role in learning and memory, has these networks, and they work in pretty much the same way. There are things that we discovered first, and then it was confirmed in the vertebrate brain, and there are many things that happen the other way around. And the most important thing that we perhaps, you know, discovered in this animal, that we could map the exact temporal relationship of the activation with various different pathways. So we see that PACAP is activated first, closely followed by NMDA receptors, MAP kinase, and all these other molecules. There are molecules that are activated very late, but they are lingering, their activation is lingering. And chem kinase, like I pointed out, also shows a second wave of activation, which is very important for much, much later memory traces. Okay? So that's a summary of the temporal relationship and time windows of the molecular requirements for memory consolidation in limnea. And now, the $64,000 question. Okay? I'm sure you've been wondering about this. Can snails get Alzheimer's disease? Well, I have to disappoint you. I cannot answer this question because Alzheimer's disease is a very complex condition. I, as an experimentalist, can only answer this question, okay? Or try to answer this question. Do amyloid peptides affect long-term memory in snails? In pretty much the same way as they're thought to affect long-term memory in human beings, okay? That's the question we can address. I cannot answer the question, can they get Alzheimer's disease? So how do we go about it? First, we look at the molecular players, the known molecular players. This is an amyloid beta peptide that is binding to a receptor, which is not known. This is a vertebrate neuron, by the way, and it inhibits the activation of adenyl cyclase, PK, and CREB, all the known players in both the limnea and the vertebrate brain, okay? So starting on this point, we did some experiments. I had a very talented Medicare student funded by the Wolfson Foundation working in my lab, who was working on this as a project. And she showed that if you treat live snails with a derived amyloid beta peptide, it's a very short sequence of an amyloid beta peptide, then this causes profound impairments in learning and memory consolidation of limnea. What it does, it will prevent memory consolidation, and also it will lead to an inability of the animals to learn or relearn what they have forgotten, which is very important. And these are very, very similar to the symptoms of what happens in Alzheimer's patients. And she also discovered another interesting thing, that the animals actually lose, upon treatment with this amyloid beta peptide, which happens here in this particular case, is 24 hours after the original training, so it's not immediate. If you subject the animals to this delay treatment, then they simply lose their memory. They lose everything, they forget everything they had learned up to that point, okay? And again, there's an inability to relearn, or the memory, for the memory to spontaneously recover as a result of this treatment of the amyloid beta peptide, okay? Now I come to the general conclusions of my lecture. So these are very, very general conclusions, I have to warn you. Invertebrates are simple, I openly admit it, but despite the apparent simplicity of the invertebrate brains, there are very complex molecular mechanisms that are playing a role in learning and memory formation in these animals. The second important point is many of these processes show a huge level of conservation between invertebrates and vertebrates. I mentioned this in my lecture previously. And this is just a very optimistic general conclusion. I usually show this to people who are willing to, or unwilling sometimes, to give me money to fund my research. So I want to convince them that studies of the molecular processes of memory in invertebrates, it's a very broad category, snails belong to this very broad category, have made, and of course will continue to make, a significant contribution to our understanding of how memory works, and even how memory can malfunction. Sometimes, you know, when things go wrong, we need to find out, and we might be able to use these invertebrate animals to get an understanding of how this happens. And while I was researching for my talk, I came across another very interesting piece of evidence. I found, if you look at this image here, okay, that the snail brain, which is a very clever design, has been reused by nature time and again. This is the cover page of Nature. Unfortunately, it's not my work, it's someone else's work. This is the first published data on the three-dimensional structure of the glutamate receptor by Sotolevsky et al. And look at the similarities between the two designs, okay? And on this note, all that remains is now just to say thanks to the many people I've been very privileged to work with, various different members of my MRC group and also the BBSRC group I was leading between 2003 and 2006. And of course, I must mention my collaborators. My longest standing collaborator is Professor Paul Benjamin and all the other people I have been privileged to work with. And of course, I have to say thank you to my family members, to my wife and all the friends and colleagues for the support. And I would like to say a few words about the places I worked. This is the place where I originally came from. This is the Balaton Limnological Research Institute of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. This is where I started my research career, scientific career. This is University of York. The Vice Chancellor mentioned that I worked there for 2 years. And of course, University of Sussex, which I now regard my home university, so to speak. And I've been here since 1992, so it's a long time. And these are all the funding bodies that gave me the money to do my research. You might notice the Soros Foundation. I got a fellowship from them in 1984. I'm not ashamed of this. But I was funded also by the Royal Society and the European Science Foundation, the Wellcome Trust. But my main grant-giving bodies, this has somehow reversed, I don't know why. But it looked all right on the original. Did it not, really? It's amazing, you know. I hope it's not some kind of omen. All right, so Medicare Research Council has been my main funder, continuous funding since 1999. And of course the BBSRC, which has just given us a lot of money. whereby Professor Michael O'Shea and Paul Benjamin and myself and some other people will be collaborating on another big project. I think that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much for your attention. I apologize if I talk too much.